Hello, I'm Rosie Perez, and you're listening to Food Fridays with Leonard Lopate on WNYC and WNYC.org.
Most journalists try to keep a distance between themselves and their subjects, careful not to cross the line from observer to participant. But Ted Conover is not a typical journalist. He's known for his undercover reporting, which has led him to travel the country with rail hobos, sneak over the Mexican border with human smugglers, and even spend a year as a prison guard at Sing Sing. For a piece called The Way of All Flesh, which is in this May's Harper's Magazine, Mr. Conover went undercover in Schuyler, Nebraska, working as a USDA beef inspector at a Cargill slaughterhouse. I'm very pleased to welcome him back to our show. Hello.
Hello again.
How do you get a job as an inspector at the USDA? Do you have to have certain qualifications?
Well, first you need to be patient because it takes a long time. It took me almost 2 years. Most people get the job through experience, often in a meat plant. But if you lack that, you can get the job through a 4-year college degree with enough math and science. And I thought I had enough, sent in my application, and was told I lacked 4 credits. So that set me back. I took an online math course to make up for it.
So you went under your own name?
I did. I did everything legally. One thing I've learned over the years is you don't lie when you do this. There's a difference between, I think, making an outright lie and then just leaving some things unsaid.
And you left out the fact that you were a journalist.
That is correct.
Were you fully certified when you got the job, a badge and all that stuff?
I carried a badge, but about a month into it, I learned that I was not fully vetted. That is, a detailed questionnaire came that I was told to return within a couple weeks, and I knew that when they looked at that, some people might start scratching their heads. But otherwise, yes, I was fully vested.
And what were your duties as a USDA inspector? Did you have to know all of the rules that are included in the federal laws going back to the Meat Inspection Act of 1906?
No. I mean, maybe with time there are refresher courses in some of these things, but I received on-the-job training that involved how to cut into the head of a cow that's hanging on a hook to look at the lymph nodes there and see if they have any abscesses. I learned how to do the same thing with the tongues that alternate with the heads, and then how to use my knife on other posts where I cut into livers looking for liver flukes in the bile ducts, and then what's called the pluck, which is the hearts and the lungs connected to each other. And these flow by in a steaming river of organs seconds after they've dropped out of the carcass.
And how often did you find things that were not acceptable?
Often. The lymph nodes are a main indicator of problems in the animal. And if there's an infection, first of all, you mark out that piece that you're looking at because it's not safe. And depending on what you find, it either can be channeled to some other use, like a liver can still be good for cat food if it just has a liver fluke. But if it has...
What is a fluke?
A fluke is a parasite that cattle drink in the feedlot. And it looks like a big paramecium, like about half an inch long. They're green, and they're alive inside the liver. And to see one is kind of a shock.
And they're large, obviously.
Yeah, and I don't think it would actually hurt us to eat that, but it's kind of gross. And
I have enough trouble just eating liver.
I don't like liver at all, except when it comes to cutting it open, because it's the easiest thing to cut. Some of this meat, it really hurts to cut.
And the abscess indicates that the whole cow would be infected on some level, wouldn't it?
Well, there are variations of the meaning of an abscess. Occasionally, it's reason to doubt the wholesomeness of a whole cow, but I think it has various meanings.
If you cut it open incorrectly, does the thing kind of explode?
Well, funny you should ask. One of my trainees, who is a prankster, kept telling me, if you see one of these lymph nodes that's extra big, make sure you nick it with your knife to see what's going on there. And when you do that, Leonard, said lymph will explode and cover the inspector with this vile green pus, and it's truly one of the most awful things that's ever happened to me. And everyone kind of chortles if you fall for it, and then you get sent to change your uniform.
And I assume that at least that piece of meat is rejected.
Yes, that's right.
And what happens to that meat?
I think most of it's rendered. We would drop those heads through a box in the floor where it would go down into the basement of the plant with other byproducts that get treated and often used in various ways. But if it's really badly infected, then it's taken to the landfill.
As a beginner, did you find it difficult to keep up with the other inspectors?
Yes. So I may have some talent as a journalist, but I don't have a lot of talent with a knife. And
I have tried once. I did a television show, and they tried to teach me how to butcher a carcass.
Uh-huh.
It's not so easy.
It's not so easy.
They said
easy.
Just slide the knife down along the bone. Easier said than done.
It's highly skilled labor. And the first thing they ask you when you get to the job is not, what was your four-year degree in, but have you ever used a knife? And, well, sure, I've used a knife. I cut steak. And then they just shake their heads. So, no, you haven't used a knife, which means you haven't held one and cut pieces of meat all day long, one after another. And all kinds of nuance become incredibly important then. Are you chopping? Are you sliding? How are you holding your wrist? Are you sharpening your knife properly?
So do they have a little bit of contempt for you? First of all, they spotted you as an outsider, somebody from New York.
Yeah. You know what? I think they thought I was probably a kind of loser because here I am 55 years old. I took a job for $15 an hour in a part of the country that's not the most popular to live in. And so I was a curiosity and I think to some degree an object of pity.
My guest is Ted Conover. His latest article, The Way of All Flesh, is in the current issue of Harper's Magazine. In terms of skills and effort, was this more difficult than being a prison guard?
So that difficulty, which I know about from working at Sing Sing, is almost all on a psychological level. It's really stressful to manage 60 or 80 inmates who surround you on a given day and don't always wish to make your job easy. It's totally stressful. But the stress of trying to keep up on the head's line, like to finish your cutting before the head turns a corner and then many people can see that you are behind, that's a different kind of stress. And it involves, you know, I'm not so proud that I don't care if they know I'm not good with a knife, but I didn't want to get fired for not being able to keep up. So the first month was very stressful.
And then you talk about getting carpal tunnel syndrome only a couple of days into the job.
Well, I don't know when it became carpal tunnel syndrome, but it sure started to hurt after a few days. And a worker suggested I get a brace to straighten my hand while I slept because the pain was waking me at night. I've never had that happen. And she was right. It really helped to wear a brace at night. And other things that inspectors suggested were totally helpful. So part of this job is learning how to manage pain. And for some people, it means taking 3 Advil before you start work. For some, it means getting shots to reduce the swelling in your carpal tunnel. But when you complain, they make fun of you.
Even though they all were experiencing the same thing.
Oh, yes. And having 10 years on the job doesn't mean you're hurting any less.
Does your wrist still hurt?
No. Now it's only my elbows that still hurt. That's a different issue.
So it's like tennis elbow?
Yes. So it's more like, I think I've heard it's called golfer's elbow. It hurts under the elbow instead of on top when I lift anything.
How long did it take you to master the job? You were there just a month and a half.
Right.
Did you ever get to the really competent level?
I'd say that at the end it started to get a little boring, which is a sign, I think, of some degree of mastery. I had colleagues who were able, it seemed, to take micro naps between, you know, in the 6 to 10 seconds between hearts. You'd see their eyes flutter closed, and then they'd snap back just in time. And I never quite achieved that level of accommodation, but I got better.
Although the inspectors are employees of the USDA, the U.S. government, doesn't Cargill house them? Does that present a conflict of interest?
Well, I sure thought it would encourage inspectors to be friendly to Cargill, because here you are, you're embedded by law in their factory. There's a locker room just for inspectors. There's a meeting room where we would sit around and eat popcorn on a break. There's special parking places, and our badges get us in, and they can't look in our bags the way they can all the regular workers. We have a sort of privileged status there. And our wage begins where the regular worker's wage tops out at like $15 an hour.
But there's something similar to what we see with embedded reporters on the front.
I know exactly what you mean. And I really doubted that it would be possible to do a good job as an inspector when you were part of this corporate environment. And in fact, when you're in a little town whose existence depends on this company, because they are by far the biggest employer around. And so that's something I was looking for. Can these people do their jobs effectively under these circumstances?
Did you feel that you were working as much for Cargill as you were for the U.S. government?
This is the thing. I didn't. I expected to, but time and again, I was encouraged to press the red button that stands next to me at every post where I worked to stop the line. If I saw something wrong that needed the attention of management from Cargill, I was to push that button.
And then what happened? Somebody came
over?
The
entire plant, well, excuse me, the slaughter part of the plant, the kill floor where I worked, comes to a standstill. So by pushing that button, I can idle over 100 workers easily, including all my colleagues, but mostly Cargill workers. And then the manager rushes over to see what the problem is. You point it out. They fix it. It's usually a matter of minutes. But one inspector told me he'd heard, you know, every minute you shut down that line costs the company $10,000. That's probably an exaggeration, but you know it costs them a lot. And we were encouraged to stop it down anytime we were worried at all.
So there was bonding between the inspectors, but not necessarily with also, with the meat handlers.
No, though there's a lot of, you know, people who, put it this way, between inspectors and managers, there's a lot of people who go to the same church or who went to the same high school. They meet at their kid's school after work. Most of the workers there are Mexican Americans or Guatemalan Americans, recent immigrants who are not socially as close with most of the inspectors or managers who tend to be more Caucasian.
And a lot of the workers seem to blame the immigrant labor that replaced them during one of the strikes. There have been a couple of strikes.
Yes, there
at
have
the plant.
Some angry strikes over lowering of wages.
Isn't there a union?
There's a union which once had some clout, doesn't seem to have nearly as much now, and it just seems local people are resigned to lower wages. There's some, you know, there's anger, residual shame about that, I think, but that's just the way it is.
And the union local has little clout, little power?
It's just the industry as a whole lowered its wages around the same time. Plants were shut. The Schuyler plant itself was shut for many months.
Well, you can't ship these jobs to China.
No. This meat is grown in the U.S. and it makes sense to harvest it here. So the companies have a lot of leverage, and it's the availability of lower wage labor that has brought that wage down.
My guest is Ted Conover. His article, The Way of All Flesh, Undercover in an Industrial Slaughterhouse, is in the current issue of Harper's Magazine. We'll continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We're back with Ted Conover. His article, The Way of All Flesh, Undercover in an Industrial Slaughterhouse, is a featured article in the current issue of Harper's Magazine, the May issue. You talked about the immigrants who are working in this plant. We're talking about the middle of Nebraska. Have they changed the town of Schuyler?
Well, profoundly. In the last 25 years or so, this has gone from a mostly white, town made up of the descendants of Middle Europeans to 80% or 90% Latino, and a huge disruption.
Are there any good places to eat there?
Well, it depends on how you like your food. I'm a fan of Mexican food. I'm a fan of taco trucks, and there's lots for me.
While you were on the line, you met a representative for Eli Lilly. What was she doing there?
So it's funny. I think she was sort of embedded as we were. And Lilly, produces Tylosin, which is an antibiotic used to treat these abscesses in the livers of cattle, which develop when the cattle are switched from grass to grain in a feedlot. She was monitoring the number of livers we would stamp out, which is we'd find a problem involving an abscess, we give it a stamp so the workers know what to do with it, or two stamps if it's quite bad. And she would stand there with a clipboard and monitor us. And it's incredibly loud in the slaughterhouse. It's very hard to talk. Eli Lilly would not respond to Harper's request for clarification about her job.
Although now they have said that you got some things wrong here.
Right. So what I understood her to say was the antibiotics are correlated to the number of abscesses because they overuse of them causes the abscess. That's incorrect. The antibiotics prevent the abscess. And the issue, though, why it's interesting that Eli Lilly is there inside an industrial slaughterhouse is that the larger issue around antibiotics is over their subtherapeutic use. The way that cattle are fed antibiotics in order to increase their growth, which we still do in the U.S., so they don't do it in Canada or Europe anymore.
This doesn't happen with cattle that are just totally grass-fed.
That is a good question. I'm not positive of the answer.
Did you find out whether the antibiotics affect the meat? We're ingesting those antibiotics.
Well,
are they affecting the humans?
You know, some scientists say that the antibiotics are effectively filtered out before the meat is slaughtered. But there are discussions over the degree to which that is true and in which cases.
Now, I'm sure you, as part of your research before you took the job, you read The Jungle by Upton Sinclair.
Yeah.
The famous book that really led to meat inspection in the first place. Did you see anything like what he had written about?
You know, I certainly looked for it everywhere because that's what's expected of a journalist in a slaughterhouse. And we read so much about bad things in meat. There's such awareness now of the conditions of slaughter. And
every once in a while we have a scandal.
That's correct. And it's about,
despite the food inspectors?
Yep. So bacteria still gets on meat, especially in ground meat, which is downstream from where I worked. But in grinding plants, inspectors check for antibiotic contamination, but they don't check everything. And sometimes it gets through with deadly consequences. Tons of people die from that. But I'll tell you what reminded me of The Jungle was the day I was standing at the viscera table and something came by that looked just like my dog after a bath. It was wet. It looked like a dog until I noticed at the end of its legs were hooves. Turns out that's a fetus. Occasionally, heifers who are supposed to be virgins and not have born cattle, they may still be pregnant and they get slaughtered. And often they'll come by inside the uterus more often. And then I started seeing that all the time, these big envelopes containing bony, bumpy things. But to see the actual proto-cow there, is upsetting. It really is upsetting.
It is one of the reasons bacteria still can get into this meat that the inspections are visual. You're not really checking the meat for too much bacteria or anything else in it.
Well, if we see excreta or ingesta on the meat, which sometimes we do, that's something we are worried about. And that's how that's one way bacteria makes its way into a grocery store. Since The Jungle came out, though, the perils of eating bacteria have extended in new ways, especially to kinds of, food like produce or seafood, things that don't come out of a slaughterhouse and that you have to test using other methods.
Now, from what you've been saying, I get the feeling you think we should be reassured that the process generally works pretty well.
I think the process generally works pretty well on the USDA side of things. There are anytime there's a meat recall, the system has failed, right? Some food got out there that was not safe. And it seems it's entirely possible that next week there will be some gigantic recall that makes it totally look like the inspection system failed. But the people I saw at their jobs were conscientious, doing what they were told, and the end result seemed to be clean beef.
You were on the last edition of On the Media, WNYC's media show, talking about the ethical aspects of undercover reporting. So can we talk about that?
Absolutely,
for a
yes.
Undercover reporting is nothing new. Didn't Nellie Bly fake her way into a mental asylum as a patient?
Absolutely. And that seems to me the kind of use of the approach that is valid. Is there a place which the public would not know about except for someone like me or Nellie Bly getting in there and telling about it?
But there are a lot of people who object, and even there have even been some court cases that have come down against this kind of reporting. What is the objection of editors?
I think the main objection is the element of doubt introduced in a reader's mind when they see that this reporter may not have been completely disclosing to the people he or she were talking to. And therefore, can they be trusted to speak the truth to a reader?
In 1997, a jury awarded $5.5 million in punitive damages against ABC for a hidden camera expose of Food Lion Incorporated,
right,
on Primetime Live.
Right.
And nobody, Food Lion didn't say that the report was incorrect, but it still won the case.
Yeah, so that turns out that didn't turn into a First Amendment case. It's the decision hinged on ABC's fraud in coming up with resumes containing fake information. So they misrepresented who these people were trying to get work in the meat department of the grocery store.
Well, to some degree, you've done the same thing.
But I don't make up anything on my resume. It's all true.
Could you have done this report in Iowa, where a law has been passed that makes it illegal for journalists and animal rights activists to take jobs at slaughterhouses to document what goes on?
Yeah, inside? Really good question. So that law passed just after I'd applied for my job, and then it spread. I mean, 6 states so far have passed these ag gag laws. All of them right now are targeted at hidden at video and photography of meat production or food production facilities. I didn't go in with a hidden camera. That wasn't my goal. So in those cases, I'd be okay. Nebraska, where I worked, is considering a law like that right now, and I don't know what the details would be. One that Arkansas is considering doesn't just apply to photography. It would have included what I was doing.
And what is how do they justify passing those kinds of laws? Because in the end, at least the public would realize that your concern is our safety.
Exactly. And it truly seems to me a short-sighted effort to get rid of the problem by killing the messenger. The way to get rid of the problem is to fix these plants so that animals aren't abused there, because
did you see any animal abuse?
My work was mainly about dealing with the animal once killed.
So you never were on the slaughterhouse floor?
Well, I was on the kill floor, but here's what happens. The animal is killed within seconds of entering the building. It comes in through a dark chute, and then it's very quickly gotten on the head by this captive bolt gun. It's knocked, is the phrase. Outside, I watched as the cattle ascended the curving ramp designed by Temple Grandin, but only with the encouragement of cattle prods, which she, I believe, is against, and which it turns out Cargill says they don't allow their plants to use. But the cattle don't want to go up there. And is that abuse? It depends on your point of view. They also get bruised while arriving, apparently, in these cattle pots, these big trailers. And sometimes we have to tell a trimmer to cut out that bruised meat. Is that abuse? I think it is.
Although you change the names of many of the people you write about, have any of them confronted you after you've published a piece?
Not yet. So I told the people I worked with that I had written articles and that I thought this would make a good article because people in places like New York don't know what this is like. And they agreed people in places like New York don't know what this is like.
Did they encourage you to do it?
Yeah, just like my coworkers at Sing Sing did. And I asked them fact-checking questions before the piece came out, and I sent them early copies of the article. And I have not heard yet from anyone who condemns me for it. It's not to say that won't happen, but so far, so good.
Undercover cops have often talked about the stress of going undercover and becoming somebody else and having to remember your cover story. Is that a problem in this kind of reporting?
You know, if you're doing undercover narcotics investigation, yeah, you have some of the same difficulty of becoming a different person or embracing a different persona. That's really hard to do for a long time. But for better or worse, when you're a meat inspector, you don't have the temptations of illegal drugs and fast women and big piles of money to lure you from the straight and narrow.
You just have to watch out for abscesses exploding in your face.
Exactly.
But there is that whole matter of objectivity because I know on some jobs, just right. based on the way I had to interact with the people who were my bosses, that I wasn't always so happy, which had absolutely nothing to do with the subject at hand.
That's absolutely true. And I do think a journalist's objectivity is compromised when that journalist embeds in another situation. But I go in hyper aware of that, and I try to do that Keatsian thing of negative capability. I keep this identity alive and my journalist identity alive by changing out of my uniform at the end of the day, going home, putting on my jeans, and typing into a computer what I just saw. So I'm the journalist at night, and I'm the inspector in the day.
And that's what I was going to ask you about next. You obviously can't take notes. You have to try to remember everything that you saw?
You can take notes during a bathroom break, during, you know.
Can you bring recording equipment in?
I could have. I did
People
not.
People say, hey, Ted's talking to himself again.
Yeah, right. No, I could have. And in fact, anybody who carries a smartphone is carrying a recorder into work and a camera, speaking of that. But, you know, my notes are written, and every time I took one, it reminded me why I was there.
Which is?
To write an article like this one for Harper's.
On your last day in Schuyler, you shared a steak dinner with Stan, one of the senior inspectors. After handling dead cows for weeks on end, did you still have an appetite for beef?
So that's the thing. The good news was he invited me out to dinner on my last night. And the bad news is that, like all the other inspectors, he loves meat. Even a guy there who'd worked in a hot dog factory still told me he eats hot dogs. And I hadn't eaten beef in a whole month. And
because he just had enough beef?
It was the viscera table. It was the sight of that, those things going by, and then the sight of the live cattle outside. It just gave me a bad feeling, and I stopped eating beef. I still ate chicken and tacos and shrimp and other stuff. But when he invited me out, I knew it was a moment of truth, and that's how I end the article is. With that medium rare T-bone being delivered in front of me and watching Stan take the first bite and his wife take the second and I lift it to my lips for the third.
Well, you say now you don't eat ground beef, but there's ground beef and ground beef. In the old days, ground beef usually was something that you watched the butcher do.
Mm.
Now it all comes in wrapped in plastic at the supermarket. Is it ground somewhere in Nebraska?
Oh, yeah. There's a grinding plant 15 miles away in Columbus. So, yes, it is ground there. But these plants don't use just local beef. They use beef flown in from other countries even. So that's where an element of uncertainty is introduced, is there. Who knows who the inspectors were at that plant?
Well, inspectors are also looking at chicken. They're looking at pork, at lamb. They're looking at eggs.
Right.
Are you, after this experience, satisfied that that food is generally safe in this country?
It's funny. It's raised my awareness to a degree where I look at food now before I take a bite. I look more carefully than I used to. That said, I love to eat, and I love meat. I'm not proud that I do, but I do. And
this didn't make you into a vegetarian.
It didn't, and in a way, that would have been the proper moral trajectory of this tale. And in fact, the first commenter on Harper's website took me to task for not becoming vegan, and I get that, but I can't pretend that I don't still like meat.
But now you're a lot more selective.
I'm saying. More careful.
Would you recommend a career in beef inspection?
If you are from that part of the country and you are tired of working in the factory, yeah, it's a step up. I would hope that would not be your last career move, but it's not a bad job.
Well, you said that most of the people who are working in the other parts of the factory, not inspectors, are immigrants.
Right.
I'm sure a few of them are legal. Would they be able to move up?
Yes, but it's harder. So Carolina, who I started with, was born in Mexico. She'd just gotten her citizenship the year before. But she finished high school and had experience in the industry. The system isn't biased at all against immigrants. It's just that they need the same qualifications and it takes them longer to get them.
You have, I'm not going to ask you what it is because we wouldn't want to blow your cover, but do you have your next undercover assignment set up?
Let's just say some seeds have been planted.
I'm not sure that I want to pursue that any further. But it's interesting that you call this The Way of All Flesh. It's the title of a pretty famous novel on a very different level, about a very different topic. I guess you could have called it The Jungle Updated, too, couldn't you?
I guess so. And if there's something I particularly like about that title, it's not the implication that we're all going to a slaughterhouse, but it's this implication that we are all animals. And there was a day in the locker room there at Cargill where my fellow inspectors all were changing out of their bloody uniforms into their clean street clothes. And I thought, you know, this is what predation. I'm part of predation. I'm part of a group of animals that's killing another group of animals for food. And we have this highly rationalized and efficient way to do it. But at a certain level, this is a very primal function, a very primal part of who we are. We are predators killing animals, and we're just doing it on a very huge scale.
Is there a smell attached to this job?
Yes. It's the kill floor is moist and warm because of the heat coming off these carcasses. They stay warm for hours and hours and hours. And it, you know, does blood have a smell? I think it does. Maybe it's iron. It's something. It smells like fresh meat. And if you've just eaten lunch, that's a little hard to get used to.
So you were eating, what, mostly salads at lunch?
Yeah, which is, of course, another reason to suspect me of being some infiltrator outsider is that I wasn't eating casseroles and fried hamburgers or whatever. Yes.
Ted Conover is distinguished writer in residence at New York University's Arthur L. Carter Journalism Institute and the author of The Roots of Man, New Jack and Coyotes, among other books. And his latest article is The Way of All Flesh, Undercover in an Industrial Slaughterhouse, in the May issue of Harper's Magazine. Thank you so much for being with us again.
Pleasure. Thanks so much.